This is The Guardian.
Today, where does the CAS review leave the trans teenagers who need support?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So I was really like a tomboy for like most of my childhood. And then about age 12, I think I realised I was trans.
This is Chase, not their real name. They're 17 now and studying for their A-levels.
I think I'd been feeling that way for a while before I knew what sort of label to put on it. And even then I didn't really know what was happening. And then I sort of thought, okay, 12's quite young, because I'd sort of like ingested that narrative of there's like a right time and a right age to come out. So it's like, I'll sit on this for a while.
Chase's parents noticed early on that Chase was rejecting the traditional markers of femininity and that perhaps tomboy didn't seem to fit them either. Teresa, Chase's mum, waited to see if it was something they wanted to talk about.
And then around kind of 12, 13, they would start conversations and then stop them. So we'd be walking down the street and Chase would out of thin air say, do you know there's such a thing as gender fluidity? And I kind of go, oh, okay, tell me about that then. And then they go, oh, no, I don't want to talk about that. And then they change the subject. And I think, okay, so it wasn't a surprise when they came out because we could see it happening. We'd never had a conversation about it.
When Chase was 14, they went to their GP about accessing GIDS. That's the NHS's Gender Identity Development Service. The GP also referred them to CAMHS. Those are the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services.
We didn't end up getting like actually referred to CAMHS because they were like, well, we don't really need to see you. I think that's part of the thing about the whole sort of like holistic care thing is that you sort of got to DIY it a little bit. So for years, I went to free counselling sessions through like a local charity. And that was very much where I like, especially around sort of coming out of school, having someone to like a professional to talk to and sort things out with while we were going through that, because like we couldn't get that done on the NHS.
GIDS accepted their referral in 2020, and at that time, the average wait to be seen was about 18 months. But the first appointment never came.
Nothing after that, until a couple months ago, when I got a letter before I turned 17 from like the GIDS clinic that was like, with how old you are now, and the fact that we're restructuring the service, you won't be eligible for treatment when it's available. So you're off the waiting list. You can get your GP to refer you again to the adult gender clinic.
After more than 3 years of waiting, Chase aged out of the queue. They would now be treated as an adult, which means joining another waiting list. The only specialist service for young people in England and Wales, the Tavistock, closed down this spring after years of criticism from inspectors and former staff who were worried about the over-medicalisation of children's care. A landmark review, commissioned by NHS England and conducted by Dr. Hilary Cass, laid out the scale of the problems in our youth gender services. But did it lay out a clear enough idea of how they should operate now? From The Guardian, I'm Hannah Moore. Today in Focus. What now for the thousands of teens on the gender service waiting list?
What's that wait been like? It was really... when I first got on the waiting list, it sort of... It made things a bit easier to deal with because I was like, okay, I feel horrible right now. Like, my mental health's really bad. But there is something in the pipeline. Like, there is sort of support available, not on the way, but, like, you know what I mean? And it felt really... Like, it was sort of a little bit of a boost. And then we got to about a year and a half ago, and I was like, I'm never going to be seen by anyone. It sort of made things a lot worse because I was like, I'm really struggling and there's no one that's going to help.
And the other thing that really hammered it home was at the same time they were being diagnosed with a chronic illness by the NHS, and that was moving so quickly.
That waiting list was about, I think that was about 3 months. They were like, okay, we're referring you to a rheumatologist. That took about 3 months. That moved like so quickly, that treatment. And it was very much like, okay, you're struggling. Here's what you need. And we're going to send you to like all these different places. And here are people that can help. It really hammered home how sort of like broken the gender identity service was. That like the NHS could be moving so quickly, but so slowly at the same time. And it could be like so effective in managing like my physical health, but so ineffective at managing, you know, the other side of things.
Amelia Gentleman, you've been reporting on the Cass Review for The Guardian. Dr. Hilary Cass published her report earlier this month, which was looking into the Gender Identity Development Service for young people, which was based at the Tavistock Clinic. Why did NHS England commission the report?
So the report was commissioned in 2020, and there was a few different things going on that prompted NHS England to commission it. One of them was a really sharp rise in the number of children and young people being referred to NHS services, people who were questioning their gender. In 2009, there were as few as 60 referrals. And of those 60, just 15 of them were adolescent girls. Hmm. By 2022, more than 5,000 children and young people were referred to the Gender Identity Development Clinic at the Tavistock. And almost three quarters of those people were female. So she was trying to see what was behind the exponential rise. And she was also responding to the fact that the Care Quality Commission had raised questions about the standards of care being provided by the Gender Identity Development Services within the Tavistock. There'd been whistleblowers who had raised questions about clinical practice, questioning whether some young people had been too swiftly referred onto a medical pathway. So there was a lot going on. And her review was also aiming to work out what was the correct way of handling patients in the future.
So what were her main findings?
Her main findings were that the NHS is failing thousands of children and young people, that the Tavistock was prescribing puberty blockers and masculinizing and feminizing hormones to children and young people, despite a remarkably weak evidence base, that the NHS didn't have the capacity to deal with long and growing waiting lists, and that the whole area was characterized by an exceptional degree of toxicity.
Right, and you said that one of the main concerns that Hilary Cass had in her report was about the medical interventions that some young people were having at the Tavistock, and in particular, the use of puberty blockers. Now, they put a pause on physical changes like growing breasts or facial hair. What did Dr. Cass say about those?
Well, I think one of the rationales for puberty blockers within the Tavistock was that they gave children and young people time to think, so that if they were experiencing severe gender dysphoria, they would be able to pause the onset of puberty to try to work out how they felt about themselves. Cass found that there was no evidence that puberty blockers allowed young people time to think. She noted that almost all children and young people who were prescribed puberty blockers went on to take masculinizing and feminizing hormones and went on that medical path towards transition. She was also concerned that there was a very poor evidence basis for the safety of puberty blockers and also for their effectiveness in terms of long-term evidence that they gave young people happier life outcomes.
I mean, there have been studies suggesting that puberty blockers have very positive effects for young trans people. But Hilary Cass, she looked at the way some of them had been conducted and said, we can't take these into account. Why was that?
Hilary Cass was very clear that they could only accept as part of their systematic review research that was of a high quality. And that meant ignoring some bits of research that they didn't feel were sufficiently rigorous.
Okay. And of course, it's an area that is quite hard to do what you might count as rigorous scientific studies on, because you can't do, for example, you know, a double-blind test, can you? You can't do a randomized test where people who are in such distressing situations be given a placebo.
That's right. And you absolutely can't give people who are expecting to receive a puberty blocker a placebo, because it will very quickly be obvious to them that they haven't received the drug that they were expecting to receive. But the Cass Review knows that this is a complicated area. And they say that there are ways of doing high quality research, even given those complexities. They say that the way to do it is through a cohort study. But unfortunately, to date, the cohort studies that there have been haven't been sufficiently high quality for them to include in this review.
So we talked about the lack of evidence, the difficulty of doing research in this area. But one thing that Hilary Cass wanted to do was to speak to people who work at adult clinics and get a sense of how later down the line people who'd been treated at those clinics were doing. 6 out of 7 of those clinics didn't cooperate. What's the result of that? You know, we don't know entirely why they didn't, but what's the result of them not cooperating with her research?
I think she wanted to do more than speak to the clinicians providing the services at the adult clinics. What she wanted to do was to try to do a full survey of all of the 9,000 children and young people who'd been through the services at the Tavistock over the last decade, to see what happened to them, to see what had worked for some of them, to see how many of them were happy with their outcomes. One of the real criticisms that has been placed at the door of the Tavistock Centre was that they weren't doing regular, methodical data collection on what was being offered to their patients and what the outcomes were. But she was very, very frustrated that a funded research proposal was, she described it as, thwarted by 6 of the 7 adult clinics.
Well, since the Cass Review's come out, all 7 of those adult clinics have agreed to fully cooperate. The Tavistock closed in March this year, and NHS England decided to stop prescribing puberty blockers to under 18s unless they're part of a clinical trial. And this week, Scotland's NHS has also made the same decision. Did she acknowledge the distress that could cause to somebody not having access to the puberty blockers that they feel they desperately need.
Yes. And I think when you read Cass's report and when you hear her talking about it, she's very clear that her main intention in all of this is to make sure that a group of young people who she believes have been really badly let down by the NHS over the last decade are treated with more compassion in the future.
She said that people should be given more holistic treatment than they were being offered at the Tavistock. Significantly, that their mental health should be properly supported. What did she think was lacking in the type of mental health support that people were getting at the Tavistock?
When they analysed the caseload of people who were receiving support at the Tavistock, they found that the young people who were presenting with gender identity issues often also had depression, anxiety, body dysmorphia, eating disorders, as well as autism spectrum disorder, also ADHD. They also noted that referrals to the Tavistock were often associated with higher than average rates of adverse childhood experiences, disproportionately high numbers of looked after children who are within the care system. I think Cass felt that there was an excessive focus on gender and anxieties around gender being at the root of all of this. And what she wants to see in the future is the care being provided by the NHS being brought back into a much wider, more holistic, and actually much less specialised form of paediatric care.
Dr. Aidan Kelly, you're a clinical psychologist. You worked in child and adolescent mental health before you started working in gender care at the Tavistock from 2016 to 2021, and you run your own private practice now. Dr. Hilary Cass writes in her report about the toxicity of the debate around healthcare for young trans people. How does the level of that debate feel to you, and what's it been like for you and your colleagues over the past few years to work in this area?
Well, I guess there's a level of outside noise, I suppose, that's been pretty consistent there. There's been an awful lot of misinterpretation and sensationalization of what the Cass report says or doesn't say. There's definitely an impact on, first and foremost, the trans and non-binary young people and their families, but I guess also those of us who are trying to support and help those people. It does impact on us.
Do you accept Dr. Cass's findings that mistakes were made at the Tavistock?
I mean, I do think mistakes were made at the Tavistock. I do think in one way the Tavistock was kind of set up to fail in a way, like trying to provide a service with kind of one iron tied behind your back.
What do you mean by that?
I guess the Tavistock was commissioned to run a gender service, and it was given a very specific set of criteria, it's called a service specification by NHS England, in terms of how to do that. And it was not within their gift to stray from that. And so all these kind of matters and issues that have been raised, like high levels of neurodiversity, undiagnosed and unmet mental health needs, you know, there were clinicians in that service who could have done that work. You know, myself and many of my colleagues have worked in CAMHS teams for a long, long time before ever ending up in gender. And so I guess we would have been able to kind of deliver that work. But the line was that needed to be referred back to local CAMHS. And sadly, they too were under huge pressures and strains. And so it's kind of really, really hard to support, help a family when you know what they need, they know what they need, but they simply can't access it. The scope of what the service could provide was quite narrow, really.
When you read the review, were there things that you thought that Dr. Cass had missed or misinterpreted?
First of all, I think it's important to say that the task that Dr. Cass was given was, you know, enormous. The level of complexity and politicization and polarization, that I feel takes place and plays out in this field, because we can't firmly state and agree that trans young people exist and deserve care. And I guess that a trans outcome is not a bad outcome, for example. Like, I guess for someone to be transgender is not a bad thing. It shouldn't be privileged or dissuaded over any other outcome. And so I think I didn't get that feel from reading the report, actually. It felt like this was a group of very disturbed and unwell and mentally unwell young people. And of course, sadly, there are some vulnerable people within the co-op, but there are also a huge amount, and I'd say the majority of people, who do incredibly well. And I guess one of the really nice things, although it's a very stressful week for me last week with all the media tension and trying to add my voice and a different sort of narrative to the piece, one of the really nice things actually has been is I've gotten lots and lots of messages from former patients. Mm-hmm. So I might have seen maybe when they're 14, 15, 16, and they've reached out and told me what they're doing in life, sent some photos, updates, university graduates. One of them's, hoping to be going to graduate school to do, medicine, and hopes to become a surgeon in the field. And there's, these are people who I guess back then you would have, said, oh, so-and-so's got a neurodevelopmental condition, so-and-so's had some mental health problems, and they're also trans. But, these people accessed healthcare pre-2020 and access hormone blockers, access kind of gender affirming hormones, wherever, 16 or so. It sounds like the lives are going really well. And they just got in touch to say how grateful they were that they were able to access this, this is pre-2020. And I guess I didn't get that sense from reading that report. And I thought, where are their voices really, actually?
One of the big concerns in her report was about people who've detransitioned. Mm. How concerned are you about young people being given gender affirming hormones who then later regret their decision?
Of course, I mean, that is the biggest worry and concern I have when I'm working with a young person or family. How much longevity, or how kind of stable is this going to be, really? And the last thing I would want is for someone to regret something, a decision they made 10 years prior, 5 years prior. I guess the reality is I don't have a crystal ball, and that there's no blood test, there's no brain scan, and that there's a reality that life is also for living as well. And so some young people are in a position where life is very, very limited, or one of the main hopes they have for themselves in the future is in relation to their gender and being able to live their gender in the way they feel is right for them. We, of course, under 18s, we need to be particularly careful, but there's also a level of kind of agency there that we I think we need to respect. We can't police people's bodies or social kind of presentations.
Do you remember hearing that the Tavistock was being closed down?
Yeah. We were on holiday. And I just went inside my hotel room and I was like, oh, this is the end. But there was still sort of like a little shred of hope and like, okay, I've been on a waiting list for like 3 years at this point. So like, surely someone has to see me soon. And then we read the thing that they were closing Tavistock and it was like, this is it. Like,
how did that news come over to you?
I think as a parent of a young trans person, your priority is always mental health. So trying to figure out what your child is thinking, knowing that this is probably the worst news that they've ever had. So we, as we do now, we looked at options. We kind of went, well, what's the best case scenario here? What's the worst case scenario? What can we do in a way that's going to support them but not going to put them in a position where the treatment that they're receiving is worse than no treatment at all? And that's your concern as a parent, I think. We knew there was an option of private prescription because we'd spoken to other parents of trans young people at that point where they'd asked to be on testosterone. We'd done our research. We then went to the GP, told them what we were thinking of doing and asked if they had any concerns, and they said no. We then went to Chase's rheumatologist, asked the same question, asked how that would impact their care for their condition. They said no. We took legal advice as well. And at that point, we thought, okay, we've done everything we can do. As a parent, you don't want to go outside the NHS, you know, and especially if you have a child who already has healthcare needs, the last thing you want to do is say, okay, we're going to take this part of their care and we're going to take it somewhere entirely different. It goes against every instinct that you have as a parent. It doesn't feel right. But on the other hand, you're looking at your child's mental health deteriorating and you're thinking, what can I possibly do that's going to stop them from going into a mental health crisis? And you know, which is worse? And that's kind of the situation that you end up in. I remember breaking the news and saying, you know, if a private prescription was an option, how would you feel about that? And it was like seeing an entirely different young person. And it's been that way since that point. They were very depressed. They were really struggling with living in their own skin. They didn't want to kind of, things like getting a shower, kind of self-care, choosing clothes were really, really difficult for them. And they were very isolated in themselves, just really struggling. And it's kind of a day and night thing now. They're much happier, they're more outgoing.
When did you start taking testosterone?
About a year ago. And the positive impact it has had on my life has been like sort of, it's been massive, like the impact it's had, the positive impact. And like, you know, I'm much more comfortable in myself and sort of like I take better care of myself now because I'm sort of more comfortable with like with sort of dealing with that. And I'm a lot more sort of like I used to be really, really, really anxious about sort of everything all the time. Like I feel like I have a handle on things now. You know what I mean? Like things are moving the way I want them to.
Is it expensive to get the testosterone?
Yeah, it is. What was the last prescription? 90?
98, I think.
98, yeah.
Two bottles.
Do you feel different in your body?
I think so, yeah. I feel a lot more like... I think the best way to put it is I feel a lot more myself these days than I used to, because I think there used to be a really sort of jarring disconnect. Yeah, these days I feel a lot more like I'm myself and I'm a bit more able to sort of express that, I think.
Would you say? Yeah, you definitely. We still worry, you're always going to worry about your child's mental health. You're always going to worry about your child's health. And like I say, we don't want to be outside of the NHS, but I can look at Chase and say they're a different person than they were. They are, you know, to go into your GCSEs with your mental health kind of a little bit more solid, to be thinking about A-levels and university and to be able to see a future for the, you know, for themselves. They didn't see that before and now they can do that and they've created this space where they can be themselves, and that's kind of all we wanted as parents. And so, you know, I understand the concerns. I do understand the concerns. We don't really think about anything else, but if you could see, you know, if you could see the transformation in terms of how they feel about themselves, then it's hard to argue that that's a bad thing from a mental health point of view.
Coming up, will the new NHS clinics be able to provide the level of care that young people need?
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you.
And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Dr. Kelly, one thing that really comes through in the report is the incredible weight that some people are going through and just how many people are on the waiting list. You know, more than 5,000 young people on the waiting list. There are these regional services being set up to replace the Tavistock. Do you think they're going to be able to meet that demand?
No, I mean, reality is, you know, this isn't just about gender search, but NHS services as a whole, they're kind of waiting lists everywhere, incredibly stretched. I don't see how NHS England are going to be able to successfully set up the, well, I think there's 7 or 8 regional hubs they're talking about. They might set them up, but to fully staff them and offer the fully holistic, comprehensive service that Dr. Cass has outlined in her report, while also offering specialist gender assessment and support service. This is a huge, you know, how do they, you know, I would love to say it will happen, but I guess it's hard not to be a bit skeptical. We've gone backwards over the time of the CAST review from September 2020 that was commissioned. You know, I think it was about a 2-year wait, and you had a staff team at JIDS of about 80 clinicians at that time. Yes, it was a London centric service, but actually there were outposts, I suppose. But now you've got, I think, 2 yeah. early adopter sites, and I believe only about 20 clinicians hired across those 2 sites. And I just can't see how that's progress.
Why don't the people like you who are specialists in this area want to work in those NHS clinics?
I guess in terms of values, I mean, Dr. Cass references values a number of times, maybe 6 or 7 times in her report, but she never spells out what those values should be for these new services. Like, is it okay to take an approach where actually a trans outcome is a good one? Like, is it okay to be trans and maybe be autistic as well? Is it holistic care, or are these other kind of pathways and services going to be ways of kind of delaying other sorts of care? It would have to be a clearer statement on, you know, on that, I think, from my personal position.
What did you think when you saw the CAS review? Obviously, I'm not expecting you to have read 390 whatever pages of it, but what's your kind of overall reaction to it?
I wasn't surprised by it. Do you? Like, there was nothing in there that surprised me. I think the problem is that, like, everyone can agree that, like, care for gender diverse young people is, like, it's not working. Like, it's a broken system, but, like, the problem is that no one can agree how to fix it. And it feels a lot like people are more interested in the politics of it than the actual people involved, because you hear so much rhetoric as a young trans person about you and what you are and the fact that you're, like, some sort of confused young person that's been, like, brainwashed by the internet, and, like, you don't know what you mean, and you sat there and you're thinking, well, that's not me. I know who I am. I know what I'm doing. And it feels a lot more like people are more interested in gaining sort of, like, political points rather than, like, actually trying to provide healthcare for people.
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway for me was, you know, of course we can all agree that we want good healthcare for trans young people. Like, nobody's arguing about that. We disagree on the best way to achieve that. Now, I think it's good that there's an emphasis on mental health. I think sometimes mental health and neurodiversity, and there was a thing that said most trans young people have had trauma or abuse. And I think sometimes it feels as though the urges to portray trans young people as broken in some way. And my husband and I read the takeaways from the report, and we said, you know, Chase doesn't meet any of those boxes. You know, they're not one of the kind of number that they're concerned about who were born female but are now thinking of transitioning in their teens. You know, at age 7, we could see that Chase was having thoughts about their gender identity and reading, you know, before they knew trans people, before they had the internet, all of those things. You know, they had a brilliant childhood, you know, like, not because of me, but you know, despite me. You know, they were really lucky. They had, have always had really supportive friends. They've always had really good teachers. And if there are issues for some of the trans community, then it's absolutely right that they should get that support. What concerns me is that you can take all that away and you can rebuild. But what do you do about the young people who are just entering puberty and are looking at this and saying, I will never get any care. Their bodies are changing, their mental health is declining. And we can all kick this around and kind of go, oh, you know, what's best for the children? The children are there, like there's no help for them. So what do you do as a parent if you are scanning the horizon and there is nothing coming? You know, you have a desperate child, you have a child who clearly needs to be seen, to be heard, and for the best course of action to be decided. And that's just not happening.
I think as well, that's like, that's why we started doing, you know, interviews and articles and like all this sort of stuff, is we were like, so many people are talking about trans young people. No one's looping trans young people into the conversation. And actually, we've got a lot to say. You know what I mean? No one's asking us what we think about our own healthcare or like the way we're treated in our own schools. I think it's really rare to hear from like trans young people about trans young people, which is like, to me, is part of the problem. It feels more like people talk about trans young people as like a theory or like a phenomenon than actual people who exist and are real.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Thank you so much to Chase and Teresa, to Amelia Gentleman, and to Dr. Aidan Kelly. You can read all of our coverage of the CAS review and its consequences at theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Moore. This episode was produced by Natalie Katena and Lucy Hoff. Sound design was by Solomon King, and the executive producer was Elizabeth Kassin. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. 6 factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.